Welcome to today's reading of the Telegraph Herald for Monday, March 18th. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and here is our first story. Jackson Shelter Sees Heavy Usage by Maya Bond. Once a location for area residents to pick up free groceries, the brick building on the corner of Jackson and 16th Streets now helps fill a need for shelter for Dubuque's homeless population. Dubuque Rescue Mission's Warming and Cooling Shelter, located at 1598 Jackson Street, celebrated 1 year of operations on March 13th, marking a year with nearly nonstop usage. The shelter is open each night for up to 20 men to stay. During particularly cold and hot days, it also serves as a heating and cooling center where individuals can go to escape the weather. Rick Mim, who manages the Jackson Street shelter, said the mission has expanded before by adding more beds to the mission's location on Main Street, opening transitional houses, and partnering with the Hope House. Each time, though, those expansions seem to fill up immediately. The Jackson Street shelter was no different, Min said. Nearly every night since it opened, its 20 beds have been filled. Mim said prior to the shelter's opening, some men were sleeping on the floor of the mission's dining hall. It was very difficult because it's our dining hall, and so we have to get the men up early in the morning to get all their stuff put away, get the tables all set back up, because when breakfast is served, 40 people are coming. Then lunch is served and 80 people are coming, and then for supper, another 80 people are coming, he said. The clear need was for more space prompted Mim to pursue options that would once again expand the mission's reach. I had committed myself and to our staff and board of directors that I wasn't going to go through another year of having men on the floor, he said. That's when we purchased the former food pantry at 16th and Jackson and converted that building into extra space for in the winter months when we were having people on the floor of the dining hall. However, while the goal for the Jackson Street shelter was to keep men off the floors of the dining hall, he said some still ended up there during the colder months when every bed in both locations was taken. Mission Administrator Jeff Lenhart said the additional location helps continue the mission's purpose of providing somewhere for people to stay. We just want to make sure people aren't freezing to death outside. If they're in need of a shelter, then that's why we exist, he said. While there are no current plans to expand the Jackson Street shelter, Lenhart said he hopes eventually it can be opened during the day as a drop-in center where organizations can connect individuals to resources such as food and housing assistance. Over the past year, Lenhart said, community support for not only the shelter, but the individuals staying there has been inspiring. It's just been a great feeling to see the community come together and help those that are most vulnerable in our community, he said. Mim said over the course of his several decades working with homeless individuals, the number of them who have severe mental health and additional issues has spiked and made it difficult for them to hold a job or secure stable housing. 80% are from the area here, Mim said. It's not like we're importing these people. More people are just struggling. Charles McLean is a captain at the Jackson Street Shelter, a resident who both lives and works there. He has stayed at the shelter since November and said it's nice to always know he has a bed to come back to. Through the winter, it was very helpful, McLean said. While the shelter was full during the winter, the bitter cold eased up throughout the past month and made some beds available for others to utilize. Dubuque Mayor Brad Kavanaugh said resident safety is a top priority for the city, and places such as the mission's shelters provide that for some of the city's most vulnerable populations. It is important to have those safe places for them to stay, he said. Kavanaugh said as the population of homeless individuals continues to rise nationwide, Dubuque is no exception, adding much of the problem comes down to access to affordable housing, which the city continues to make strides in improving. And our next story, Lost Honeymoon Makes Marriage Seem Easy for 65 Years. Gary and Barb Scoggin saw marriage start with ill-fated trip that failed to reach Colorado. This is by Michelle London. Waterloo, Iowa natives Gary Scoggin and Barb Gibson were students at Waterloo East High School when they first encountered each other. I was a sophomore and he was a senior, said the now Barb Scoggin, 86. We were both working on the fall play, Arsenic and Old Lace. He was a stage manager and I was a behind-the-scenes person. Barb said their first meeting was not an auspicious beginning. I had my arms full of something backstage, and I asked him if he would move my chair, Barb said. He looked at me kind of weird, but he did move my chair. And while that first meeting held no promise of a romance, Gary and Barb got to know each other more as the production progressed. We saw quite a bit of each other during that time, said Gary, now 87. By the end of the last performance, they were a couple. We ran around with a bunch of kids, Barb said. There were a couple of friends of Gary's and their girlfriends. We just had a lot of fun together. Gary graduated from Waterloo East and attended Iowa State Teachers College, now University of Northern Iowa, in Cedar Falls, not far from Waterloo. He was a commuter student because the school was close by. When Barb graduated, she got a job as a telephone operator at Northwestern Bell. While attending college, Gary worked for the city of Waterloo. The couple doesn't remember a formal proposal. I think I said, let's get married, Gary said. Gary and Barb were married on November 14, 1958, and celebrated their 65th anniversary last fall. They have three children, Chris Swenson, Sherry Neal, and Brian. They also have six grandchildren. After their wedding, Gary and Barb had plans for a wonderful Colorado honeymoon. Barb said their first mistake was a mountain honeymoon in November. We decided we wanted to go to Colorado Springs, which is stupid because there's already snow there, she said. We borrowed my dad's brand new Ford. By the time they got to Omaha, Nebraska, lights were blinking on the new Ford's dashboard. Gary pulled into the first gas station they found and put in power steering and brake fluid. But more lights kept coming on, so the honeymooning couple decided to stop for the night. We got to Hastings, Nebraska, Barb said. The hotel had one room, and it had twin beds. The trip didn't get any better after that. The car left them stranded by the side of the road, only to fire up an hour later when Gary decided to crank the ignition one more time. In Red Cloud, Nebraska, with even more lights blinking, the local gas station owner was closing up on a Saturday night, but offered to take Gary and Barb to the local motel and work on the car the next morning. The mechanic charged me $2.75, Gary said. In western Kansas, they stopped in a small town on a rainy night, but the gas station was closing up. The gas station owner directed them to an out-of-the-way garage where, on a Sunday night, they were able to get their car repaired. But Gary and Barb had had enough. After a Topeka, Kansas visit with Barb's Aunt Fern, they decided to head home. There was a blizzard coming, Barb said. That's part of the reason we turned around, and we were just ahead of it all the way home. After the children were born, Barb left Northwestern Bell to stay at home with the kids. She occasionally worked for her dad, who owned Gibson Specialty Company, a business that sold promotional products and trophies. Gary worked with the city of Waterloo for several years, heading up the city's survey crews. He left to become safety director at Chamberlain Manufacturing until it closed in the mid-1990s. Gary then was named human resources director at Eagle Window and Door in Dubuque, the job that brought the family to Dubuque. Gary retired from Eagle Window and Door in 2004. Gary and Barb both volunteered for Girl Scouts of the USA during and after their daughters were scouts. Barb was a troop leader and then became a trainer. She brought Gary on board as well. We would travel all over training people to work with Girl Scouts. He and I would do it together. Chris of Duluth, Minnesota, remembers thinking how normal her family was while she was growing up, until she discovered it wasn't. I take it for granted that nobody else's parents ever fought and that they never blew things out of proportion, she said. Then I would go to my friends' houses and there would be arguments. I remember thinking my parents might be the crazy ones. Did they argue? Probably, but not in front of us. They just knew how to talk to each other. They are members of Westminster Presbyterian Church in Dubuque, where Barb plays bells and bell choir. Barb is also an avid quilter, and Gary enjoys making connections around the world with his ham radio. They enjoy traveling, and they've taken trips to Branson, Missouri, and to visit family around the U.S. Son Brian makes his home in Brazil with two of their grandchildren, so the Scoggins have made trips to South America. They've also visited England, Scotland, and Germany. Chris said her parents have always shared a sense of humor and the ability to communicate with each other. They had a Valentine's Day card one year that they went back and forth with for years, she said. It became a joke, but they said, it says exactly what we wanted to say. They've just always been able to talk to each other. Barb said the ability to work through whatever problems might arise is a big key in their marriage. Getting married is a commitment, she said. Chris said her parents have always had respect for each other. The back and forth of caring for each other, being helpful to each other, that's just how they've always been, she said. And now it's carried into their older life together. They share so many things together. As for Gary, he jokes that more than 6 decades of marriage hasn't been all that difficult. After that honeymoon we had, 65 years was easy after that. Portrait Studio opens in new spot. This is by Grace Neeland. A well-known Dubuque portrait studio has relocated. Scott Kelly Portraits, formerly S. Kelly Photography, recently opened its new studio at 150 John F. Kennedy Road, Suite 1, after the building it previously operated out of in the historic Millwork District was sold. The new space is equipped with 2 rooms for indoor portraits, a consultation space and office, as well as a dressing room for clients' hair and makeup. We really aim for quiet luxury, co-owner Scott Kelly said of the new space. Not a lot of people still offer these kinds of elegant, high-quality indoor portraits, and that's something we take pride in. Scott Kelly is the studio's sole photographer. Chris Kelly, Scott's wife, handles the business management and client relations. The two have been in business for over 20 years, 18 of which were spent working out of their home. They moved into the Millwork District space roughly 2 years ago before learning last year that the building would be sold. When they again began looking at available commercial space, they were drawn to the JFK building for the second time. 3 years ago, when we were first looking for our first retail location, this was actually our second choice, Scott Kelly said. When we learned that it was still available, when we started looking again, we decided to go for it. The studio is best known for its indoor and outdoor portrait photography, ranging from senior photos and family portraits to more personal women's beauty and boudoir shoots. Each session is accompanied by a consultation to establish what the client is looking for, and installation services of wall portraits are included. The goal with each session, Chris Kelly said, is to ensure that clients feel comfortable and confident in front of the camera. That is particularly important with the women's beauty sessions, she added, which focus on building the women's self-confidence. It's great to get to watch people grow, she said. We'll have clients who come in and will sit at this table just scared out of their minds during the consultation, who, as we talk it through, really begin to relax and get excited to have their portraits taken. The best way to contact Scott Kelly Portraits is by text at 563-543-0306. There are also our Facebook groups for the business's family and senior portraits, as well as a separate group for women's beauty clients. Brothers in Arms, pair of Hempstead grads honored, humbled to receive Quilts of Valor by Eric Hockstrom. Brian Havel recruited his younger brother Mark Havel into the Iowa National Guard. 35 years later, both brothers received quilts honoring them for their combined 51 years of service. I'm humbled, said Brian Havel, 56 of Rock Island, Illinois. It's an honor to get to do this with my brother. Both Havel brothers graduated from Dubuque's Hempstead High School. Brian spent 29 years in the National Guard, and Mark spent 22 years in the Guard. I'm very honored, but I feel too young to get it, Mark Havel said of the quilt he received. The Northeastern Iowa chapter of the Quilts of Valor Foundation presented quilts to 7 veterans during a ceremony on Sunday at Tri-State Community Church. The Havels were the only pair of brothers at the ceremony, and their mother, Kay Havel, headed a large contingent of family members attending the event. I think they deserve it for all of the time they put in, Kay said. Mark was in Iraq for 16 months. He also was in Egypt, and Brian was in Egypt for a year. Quilts of Valor is a nonprofit organization that presents homemade quilts to service members and veterans to acknowledge their service and sacrifice. You can tell what it means to the veterans, said Cindy Billmeyer, the Northeast Iowa coordinator for the Quilts of Valor Foundation. The veterans stand up there to receive their quilts, acting all macho, but then you see the tears. Brian joined the National Guard on July 1, 1985. I was active duty for 27 years between the Iowa National Guard and Illinois National Guard, he said. I was a recruiter in Dubuque from October 1988 to 1991. Then I went to Muscatine, and I was a recruiter in Muscatine until November 1995. Then I was in the Illinois National Guard in Rock Island and Macomb. It was as a recruiter in Dubuque that Brian recruited Mark into the National Guard. I joined the National Guard after high school in June of 1989, Mark said. I was with the Iowa National Guard until 2010. Mark said serving in Iraq was difficult, but his absence was more challenging for his family members back home. When you're overseas, the people back home have it a lot rougher, Mark said. We had it rough, but we had every soldier together. That's why they say it's a brotherhood. The families back home didn't know what was going on for a long time. A highlight of Mark's service was being able to call his dad from Iraq. Ronald Havel would die 4 months after Mark returned stateside in 2007. We couldn't call Mark. He had to call us, Kay said. Finally, he said, Mom and Dad, you get cell phones. I'm tired of talking into that answering machine. Ronald Havel was fishing on Real Foot Lake in Tennessee when the phone rang in 2006, and it was Mark. It was his first cell phone call, Mark said. He couldn't believe he was talking to me from Iraq. Brian eventually followed his brother to the Mideast. I went to Sinai, Egypt, from May 2010 to May 2011, Brian said. I walked where Mark had walked over there. Sunday, the brothers followed each other to receive quilts in recognition of their service. I'm the commander of the VFW post in Moline, Illinois, so I am usually on the other side helping with stuff like this, Brian said. I'm very honored. January jobless rates rise from December in local counties in Iowa. Unemployment rates rose in local Iowa counties and fell in southwest Wisconsin, according to recently released reports. Dubuque County's unemployment rate was 3.7% in January, up from the 2.7% recorded in December, but down from the 3.8% recorded in January of 2023, according to Iowa Workforce Development. Elsewhere in the state, Clayton County's unemployment rate was 6.2% in January, compared to 4% in December and 7.1% in January of 2023. Delaware County's rate was 3.6%, up from 2.8% in December and down from 3.9% a year ago. Jackson County's rate was 4.7%, up from 2.8% in December and down from 4.8% a year ago. Iowa's statewide unemployment rate was 3% in January, unchanged from 3% in December, and up from 2.9% a year ago. In Wisconsin, Lafayette County's unemployment rate was 2.2% in January, according to Wisconsin's Department of Workforce Development. The county's unemployment rate was 2.9% in January of 2023. Crawford County's unemployment rate was 4.8% in January, down from 5% in January of 2023. Grant County's rate was 2.7%, down from 3.1% a year ago, and Iowa County's rate was 2.7%, down from 3.2% a year ago. Statewide, Wisconsin's unemployment rate was 3.2% in January, up from 2.7% a year ago. In Illinois, Joe Davis's county's unemployment rate was 6.2% in January, up from 5.2% a year earlier, according to the Illinois Department of Employment Security. Statewide, Illinois' unemployment rate was 5.1% in January, up from 4.7% a year earlier. And now some news in brief. Police: intoxicated driver led officers on high-speed chase. Police said an intoxicated driver led officers on a high-speed chase that reached speeds in excess of 98 miles per hour on Dodge Street in Dubuque. Gloria Feggins, 31, of Manchester, was arrested on the Julian Dubuque Bridge at 7:46 p.m. Saturday on charges of felony eluding, operating while intoxicated, and possession of marijuana. Court documents state that officers responded to the area of U.S. 20 and Northwest Arterial for a report of a vehicle traveling erratically in the eastbound lanes of U.S. 20. The vehicle was swerving, striking the gravel shoulder, and driving at speeds ranging from 40 miles per hour to approximately 100 miles per hour, documents state. An officer located the vehicle in the area of Dodge Street and Cedar Cross Road, where it was operating without headlights. The officer attempted to stop the vehicle, but it fled, traveling at speeds in excess of 98 miles per hour in a 45 mile per hour zone. Police stopped the vehicle in the eastbound lane of the bridge. Fagans told police that she did not stop because she did not see that police officers were driving behind her, documents state. Fagans had red, watery eyes, slurred speech, the odor of an alcoholic beverage on her breath, and was wearing a green plastic shot glass necklace around her neck, documents state. Fagans told police she had been traveling from the St. Patrick's Day parade in Dyersville, Iowa, documents state. Police said traffic was stopped on the bridge while officers arrested Fagans. Caves remain closed at the state park due to bat hibernation. Sata Maquoketa. The caves at a local state park remain closed until next month. Maquoketa Caves State Park issued a reminder that the caves will not open for exploration until April 15th due to bats' continued hibernation at the park at 9688 Caves Road in Maquoketa. Modern camping facilities also are due to reopen April 15th, according to the cave's website. Top 10 Most Read TH Stories. An article about a proposed development in the footprint of a longtime Dubuque restaurant was the most read story of the past week on TelegraphHerald.com. Here are the 10 most read stories on the website from March 11th to Sunday. Number 1, development proposed at site of longtime Dubuque restaurant. Number 2, police, Dubuque man took surreptitious recordings in workplace bathroom. Number 3, a biz buzz, Lancaster Sports Bar under new ownership, Dubuque Lifestyle Critic Health Clinic moves, Galena Service Shop opens new facility. Number 4, South Grandview Bridge demolition to begin next week. Number 5, sandwich chain to open second location in Dubuque. Number 6, Throwback Thursday, popular Dubuque bar owner profiled 45 years ago. Number 7, Love That Lasts, Tough Times, Good Times, Forgiveness, Mark Dubuque couples 51 years. Number 8, Dubuque teen sentenced for pair of school disturbances. Number 9, Grammy-nominated rock band to perform in Dubuque. And number 10, renovations at Old Cascade Brewery uncover beer cave lost to time. The police report, the Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Departments reported the following. Jennifer M. Graham, 46, of Cedar Rapids, was arrested at 5 p.m. Saturday in the 300 block of Bell Street on a charge of child endangerment. Sandra P. Bullock, 27, of 299 Main Street, number 42, was arrested at 1:25 p.m. Saturday in the 200 block of John F. Kennedy Road on charges of two counts of unlawful possession of a prescription drug. And Demond J. Hamp, 23, of 579 Quigley Lane, was arrested at 1:12 a.m. Saturday in the 1800 block of Ella Street on a charge of possession of marijuana with intent to deliver. Okay, I'm going to turn to the opinion section and read the other view column. Blame Washington, not grocery stores, for high food prices. And this is by E.J. Antoni. If you're struggling to pay for groceries, you're not alone. Staples like bread, lunch meats, dairy products, and eggs have seen price increases of 20% to 40% during the past 3 years. President Joe Biden is blaming grocery stores for gouging consumers, but there's just one problem with that explanation. His administration's own data disprove it. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, prices paid by business and consumers alike have increased 18% on average since Biden took office. The higher prices that American families face today are simply the higher cost of doing business being passed along to the consumer. Despite this fact, the White House has repeatedly called for grocery stores to lower prices, as if a business owner sets prices arbitrarily. In a recent commercial, Biden also highlighted the phenomenon of shrinkflation, where products get smaller, but the price remains the same. The president again called on companies to stop the practice, as if it could be done by executive fiat. Grocery stores cannot simply reduce the prices they charge, while the prices they themselves pay continue to rise. If a dairy farmer charges a grocer 20% more for milk, then the grocer will also charge a family 20% more for milk. That's not gouging anyone, it's merely staying in business. Over the past 3 years, firms have been slow to pass along the full freight of cost increases to consumers as those businesses sought to maintain market share. Only in the past couple of months has the increase in prices paid by consumers finally caught up to the higher prices paid by businesses. That hasn't stopped Biden from citing corporate profits, which are collectively at or near a nominal record high, as evidence of price gouging. However, he once again seems unaware of the data published by his own administration that directly contradict his talking points. These record high profits aren't adjusted for inflation. That's important because a business needs to use its earnings to buy new inventory, among other things. If the cost to replace inventory rises, then the money earned by the business doesn't go as far as it used to. The same amount of money buys less. Individuals are experiencing the same thing in their own finances. The average American worker is earning more per hour than ever before, but those earnings buy less than they did just 3 years ago. That's because prices for the things the worker buys have risen much faster than his or her wages. Adjusting for price increases reveals corporate profits have been falling lately, not rising, and record-setting numbers in business earnings are like the record wages earned by workers. Both buy less. Still, the fact that businesses are not to blame for high food prices is small consolation to American families who are having to pay not only a record high amount for food, but also a higher percentage of their income today than they did 30 years ago. And if greedy corporations gouging consumers end up not being the culprit, then what caused food prices to hit stratospheric levels so quickly? It was the unprecedented amount of government spending, borrowing, and printing of money in the past few years. By 2021, emergency COVID-19 spending was going to sunset, and federal government expenditures were set to plunge back to pre-pandemic levels. Instead, Biden advocated for replacing those trillions of dollars in one-time emergency spending with a plethora of left-wing boondoggles. Thus, multi-trillion-dollar deficits became institutionalized. Growth in government spending today has so outstripped growth in the economy that the deficit is at levels never seen outside of a recession or emergencies like a war or COVID-19. In collaboration with the big spenders in Congress, the Biden administration has added $6.7 trillion to the federal debt, and much of that borrowed money was financed by the Federal Reserve, creating it out of thin air. As the government spends, borrows, and prints money, it devalues the currency, so your dollars don't go as far as they used to. That's something to remember next time you're grocery shopping for your family and wondering why the prices are so high. Antoni is a public finance economist at the Heritage Foundation and a senior fellow at the Committee to Unleash Prosperity. Okay, I'm going to go to the Tri-State. Free for all local activities that won't drain your wallet. Let's see if we can find a few things to suggest today. From 4 to 5 p.m. in Platteville, Wisconsin, Lucky Leprechaun Crafts, student-led program at Platteville Public Library, 225 West Main Street for children ages 2 to 6 with accompanying adults. Come and participate in St. Patrick's Day crafts and activities, hunt for gold coins, make a leprechaun hat, and more. And at 6 p.m. this evening in Asbury, Iowa, professional organizer Jesse Bushman will give a presentation on spring cleaning at the Asbury branch of Dubuque County Library District. Bushman will discuss ways to declutter, organize, and simplify kitchen cabinets, counter surfaces, living rooms, and other areas. Registration is encouraged and can be made via the library website or calling 563-582-0008. And from 6 to 6:45 p.m. in Holy Cross, Iowa, Snack on Science Flowers at the Holy Cross branch of Dubuque County Library District. Learn about a science topic and do an experiment you can eat to go along with it. March's topic is flowers. And at 6 p.m. in Dyersville, Cry Cut with Christopher presents Glass Easter Bunnies at James Kennedy Public Library, 320 First Avenue E. Come learn about the Cry Cut Maker from local expert Lisa Christopher and create a glass Easter bunny. Participants should be 14 or older, but children age 8 and older are welcome if accompanied by an adult. And tomorrow from 4:30 to 5:15 p.m. in Peosta, Iowa, Snack on Science Flowers will be presented at the Peosta branch of Dubuque County Library District. You are listening to the Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we're going to turn to today's obituaries. Here are the funeral services listings. Jason D. Bartels, Dubuque. Visitation will be from 2 to 5:45 p.m. Tuesday, March 19th, Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory at 3860 Asbury Road. Service will be at 6 p.m. Tuesday at the funeral home. Betty Edge of Lancaster, Wisconsin. Visitation is from 9:30 to 11 a.m. Saturday, May 25th, at the Lancaster United Methodist Church. Celebration of Life is from at 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Joseph R. Urshan of East Dubuque, Illinois. Parish Vigil Service at 3:30 p.m. today at Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque. Visitation is from 4 to 8 p.m. today and from 11:30 a.m. to 12:15 p.m. Tuesday, March 19th at the funeral home. Mass of Christian Burial will be at 1 p.m. Tuesday at St. Raphael's Cathedral. Joanne C. Garner of Dubuque. Her service will be at 10 a.m. Friday, March 22nd. Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home at 2659 John F. Kennedy Road. Mary Ellen Gebinglinger of Madison, Wisconsin. Interment is at 10:30 a.m. today. I'm sorry, we'll have missed that. At St. Clara Cemetery in Cincinnati. Barbara E. Gratz of Fenimore, Wisconsin. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 21st, the Larson Funeral Home in Fenimore, and from 9:30 to 11 a.m. Friday, March 22nd, at St. Peter Lutheran Church in Fenimore. Service is at 11 a.m. Friday at the church. Robin G. Groom, Dickeyville, Wisconsin. Celebration of Life will be at 2 p.m. Saturday, March 23rd, at PJ's Pub in Keeler. George L. Hayward of Cibola, Iowa. Visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. today and 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, March 19th. La Jones Funeral Home in Preston. The service is at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday at the funeral home. Stanley C. Hofer of Epworth, Iowa. Visitation is at 9 a.m. today. Reef Funeral Home in Epworth. Mass of Christian Burial will be at 10:30 a.m. today. I'm sorry, again, we will miss Stanley's visitation, and his Mass was today at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Epworth. William J. Kirstein, K-E-R-S-T-E-I-N, Kirstein, of Dubuque. His service will be at 1 p.m. Saturday, March 23rd, Veterans Memorial Plaza, 1795 Admiral Sheehy Drive, followed by a celebration of life at Nancy's Slots in East Dubuque, Illinois. Brittany J. Lansing of New Vienna, Iowa. Visitation will be from 2 to 8 p.m. today and from 9 to 10 a.m. Tuesday, March 19th at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Service is at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday at St. Boniface Catholic Church in New Vienna. Vicki M. Myers, Dyersville. Visitation from 2 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, March 19th, and from 10:30 to 12:30 p.m. Wednesday, March 20th, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Service will be at 1 p.m. Wednesday at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. Mark A. Menson of Earlville. His visitation is from 2 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, March 20th, and from 9 to 10 a.m. Thursday, March 21st, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. His service will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday at St. Joseph Catholic Church. Terry J. Meyer of Dyersville. Visitation was at 9 to 10 a.m. today at the Kramer Funeral Home. And his Mass of Christian Burial was at 10:30 a.m. today at St. Francis Xavier Basilica. Louis J. Powell, Jr. of Benton, Wisconsin. Services from 9 to noon on Saturday, March 23rd at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. C. Patrick Smith of Dubuque. His visitation will be 3 to 8 p.m. Friday, March 22nd at Reef Funeral Home in Epworth. Services are at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 23rd, St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Epworth. Evelyn H. Vondran of Dubuque. Her service was at 10:30 a.m. today at Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena, Illinois. And also Donald C. Welsh of Dubuque, his Mass of Christian burial was at 10:30 a.m. today, St. Joseph Key West Catholic Church. Okay, and now we're going to turn to the sports section. Fighting Saints earn another pivotal weekend sweep. This is the United States Hockey League. By Jim Leitner. From starting an hour late due to ice issues, to the weird optics of a green playing surface, to a 5-on-3 penalty kill in crunch time, the Dubuque Fighting Saints answered all kinds of adversity Saturday night. Kevin Riedler made 36 saves, the penalty kill completed a perfect weekend, and the Saints protected a 2-goal lead en route to a 3-1 victory that completed a 2-game sweep at Muskegon. Dubuque, which secured a 13th straight USHL playoff berth Friday night, improved to 34-12-3-3 to maintain a 7-point cushion on second place Green Bay in the Eastern Conference. "It was really important to us to sweep this weekend," said defenseman Jonah Vassanen, who tallied a goal and an assist. "It's pretty obvious with the whole team that we want to be the first seed, and we like to call these games 4-point games when we're playing teams right behind us. It was huge to get these last 4 wins." The Saints swept a 2-game series at Youngstown 2 weeks ago. Youngstown and Muskegon both have 64 points, 10 behind Dubuque, but could have narrowed the gap by protecting their home ice. Saturday's game almost didn't happen. As part of a St. Patrick's Day promotion, the Lumberjacks painted the ice green enough to make it hard to read the markings on the surface. It also led to choppy ice and an hour for repairs before puck drop. "I voted not to play," Saints coach Kirk McDonald said. "It was down to the cement in some spots. They got it playable, but it was a lot like road hockey as the night went on. Credit the guys, they all did a great job of staying dialed in. You have to just laugh it off in a situation like that and roll with the punches. Years from now, they'll have a story to tell their buddies. That first round of shifts, they were all awesome. They all had a lot of energy." Riedler improved to 23-5-2-2, lowered his goals against average to 3.01, and raised his save percentage to an even 900 despite the strange optics. The maintenance staff restored a white edge around the rink at the direction of the USHL earlier in the day, but the middle of the ice remained Kelly Green. "It was something new, but it felt kind of like the small area games we play at practice," Riedler said. "I just tried to have fun out there, and it worked out pretty good. It was definitely different, but I prefer to play on regular ice. It was more challenging. It's not as easy to read they play, so maybe it forces the goalie to stay on his toes a little more." Dubuque's fourth line created havoc on one of its first shifts on the game, and Teddy Merrill capitalized with his 8th goal of the season at the 3:35 mark. Josh Giuliani and Nick Romeo pressured Flip Nordberg into a turnover behind the Muskegon net, and Merrill ripped a quick wrist shot inside the left post to beat a surprised goalie, Shikabadin Gadziev. "It's easy to make excuses, or you can point fingers after a big delay like that," said Merrill, an Arizona native. "I don't have any experience playing on a pond, but it's kind of what it felt like. The Minnesota boys thrive for sure. I wasn't going to try too many stick handles. We did a good job of coming out hot despite the delay. Credit to our team, especially my line mates. It's fun playing with those guys and Andrew King." Vassanen doubled the lead at the 13:16 mark of the second period with his 8th goal of the season following a stellar individual effort by Eric Palson. Palson took a Killiam Dick pass along the right wing just outside the Muskegon blue line and slipped between Cody Kroll and Bauer Berry for a straight path to the net. Palson tried to outweigh the goalie, but Gadziev made the initial save. Paulson gathered the rebound and fed Vassanen, who slipped a shot through Gadziev's pads from the top of the blue paint while the goalie moved side to side. I saw an open space in the middle of the ice, so I went to the net, Vasanen said. Paulson put it right on my tape. I shot it, and it went in. Just 1 minute, 45 seconds later, Muskegon scored its first goal in 95 minutes and 1 second of game time in the series. David Klee potted his 13th goal of the season on a rebound after Justin Solovey and Easton Young worked the puck on Riedler. The Lumberjacks thought they tied the game at the 16-minute, 55-second mark, but the on-ice officials waved off the goal, ruling Teddy Spitznagel punched the puck past Riedler with his right hand. Then 39 seconds into the third period, and with Muskegon enjoying a 5-on-3 power play, Kroll had a goal taken off the board for a similar play with his left hand. He was my guy, so I saw straight away he pushed it in, Vasanen said. Riedler and I told them to take a look at it on video, and they agreed with us. The Saints, who own the USHL's top penalty kill, went 7-for-7 this weekend against the league's third-best offense. We had a great pre-scout from our coaches, Vasanen said. We knew pretty much their every move before they even did it. We did a great job of taking away those plays that they've succeeded at in the past. The 5-on-3 was huge. The whole team knew if we were going to win, that was an essential kill. The guys were pretty pumped after we killed that one. Noah Powell sealed the victory on an empty net goal with 9.3 seconds to play in regulation. Vasanen iced the puck, but Powell won the race and tapped it into the net for his 31st goal of the season and fourth of the weekend. In college basketball, Illinois 93, Wisconsin 87, Big Ten Conference Championship. Illinois wins Big Ten. Shannon drops 34 points as Illini edge Wisconsin in title game. Out of Minneapolis, Terrence Shannon Jr. scored 34 points on 15-for-17 shooting from the free throw line, helping 13th-ranked Illinois outlast Wisconsin 93-87 in Big Ten Tournament Championship game on Sunday afternoon at the Target Center. Marcus Domask added 26 points, 8 assists, and 7 rebounds, and Dane Danja had 9 points and 7 rebounds for the Illini, whose record is 26-8. Who won their second conference tournament title in 4 years after shooting 16 of 26 in the second half. They faced a double-digit deficit in all three games. It was a little bit different every night, Coach Brad Underwood said. I love that. A.J. Storr had 24 points, and Chucky Hepburn added 20 points for the Badgers, whose record was 22-13, who went 7-for-20 from three-point range after going 33-for-79 over their first three games. Shannon finished with 102 points in three games, one short of the Big Ten tournament record, and was voted the most outstanding player. Keegan Murray had 103 points for Iowa in 2022, but the Hawkeyes played four games that year on the way to the title. After celebrating in a shower of orange and blue confetti and cutting down the nets at Target Center, the Illini hustled to a side room for the NCAA tournament selection show to learn they're the number 3 seed in the East region, with a first-round game on Friday against Morehead State. Wisconsin got the number 5 seed in the South region and a first-round matchup against James Madison. My hat's off to Wisconsin. Boy, are they good. They'll make a lot of noise, Underwood said. Shannon, who broke the Big Ten tournament single-game record with 40 points in the semifinal win over Nebraska, still faces a rape charge in Kansas for an alleged incident last year. His school-issued suspension was overruled by a federal judge after 6 games. The Wisconsin fans taunted him often, but he's not easily rattled. He coolly pulled up for a 3-pointer off the break to give Illinois a 41-40 lead with 31 seconds left before halftime, blowing a kiss at the crowd of 13,991 that was heavy with red-clad Badgers fans. Hepburn's 3-point play gave Wisconsin a game-high 61-51 lead, but Illinois went on a 21-5 run over the next 6 minutes to ensure a tight finish. Max Klesmit made a 3-pointer for an 82-81 lead with 3 minutes 53 seconds to go, and another for the tie with a minute 57 left, but Shannon answered that one from deep on the other end to make it 88-85 with 88 seconds left. Then he stole a careless dribble from Storr on the other end, drove the other way to draw a foul, and sank both free throws for a 5-point lead. Sometimes in my career, there's been moments when those threes would have just destroyed everything, said Coleman Hawkins, who had 7 points, 6 rebounds, and 2 blocks. We made some mistakes, but we were able to keep playing. Hepburn was a hero of Wisconsin's overtime victory over top-seeded Purdue in the semifinals on Saturday, hitting the tying layup at the buzzer in regulation and drawing a key charging foul to set up Klesmet's winner. The junior guard passed the 1,000-point mark for his career in this game and contributed in all kinds of ways after sitting out the quarterfinal win over Northwestern because of a knee injury. I feel like he's one of the best players in our league, Hawkins said. When he's aggressive, I feel like they're a really good team. Illinois won the only regular season matchup between these teams 2 weeks ago at a 91-83 victory, fueled by Domask's 31 points in the Wappan Natives' first game in Wisconsin since high school. The transfer from Southern Illinois, a first-team All-Big Ten pick with Shannon, shot 8 for 11 in this game. To come here and get the ring, this is the conversations, the visions I had with Coach during the recruiting process, Domask said. And we came here and got the job done. Okay, I'm going to go to the lifestyle health section with an article, Why COVID Patients Who Could Most Benefit from Paxlovid Still Aren't Getting It, by Arthur Allen. Evangelical minister Eddie Hyatt believes in the healing power of prayer, but also the medical approach. So, on a February evening, a week before scheduled prostate surgery, he had his sore throat checked out at an emergency room near his home in Grapevine, Texas. A doctor confirmed that Hyatt had COVID-19 and sent him to CVS with a prescription for the antiviral drug Paxlovid, the generally recommended medicine to fight COVID. Hyatt handed the pharmacist the script, but then he said, "She kept avoiding me." She finally looked up from her computer and said, "It's $1,600." The generally healthy 76-year-old went out to the car to consult his wife about their credit card limits. "I don't think I've ever spent more than $20 on a prescription," the astonished Hyatt recalled. That kind of sticker shock has stunned thousands of sick Americans since late December, as Pfizer shifted to commercial sales of Paxlovid. Before then, the federal government covered the cost of the drug. The price is one reason Paxlovid is not reaching those who need it most. And patients who qualify for free doses, which Pfizer offers under an agreement with the federal government, often don't realize it or know how to get them. If you want to create a barrier to people getting a treatment, making it cost a lot is the way to do it, said William Schaffner, a professor at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine and spokesperson for the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Public and medical awareness of Paxlovid's benefits is low, and putting people through an application process to get the drug when they're sick is a non-starter, Schaffner said. Pfizer said it takes only 5 minutes online. Doctors are aware about prescribing it because of dangerous... Doctors are wary about prescribing it because of dangerous interactions with common drugs that treat cholesterol, blood clots, and other conditions. It must be taken within 5 days of the first symptoms. It leaves a foul taste in the mouth. In one study, 1 in 5 patients reported rebound COVID symptoms a few days after finishing the medicine, though rebound can also occur without Paxlovid. A recent JAMA Network study found that sick people 85 and older were less likely than younger Medicare patients to get COVID therapies like Paxlovid. The drug might have prevented up to 27,000 deaths in 2022 if it had been allocated based on which patients were at highest risk from COVID. Nursing home patients, who account for around 1 in 6 U.S. COVID deaths, were about 2/3 as likely as other older adults to get the drug. Shrunken confidence in government health programs is one reason the drug isn't reaching those who need it. In senior living facilities, a lack of clear information and misinformation are causing residents and their families to be reluctant to take the necessary steps to reduce COVID risks, said David Gifford, chief medical officer for an association representing 14,000 healthcare providers, many in senior care. The anti-vaxxers spreading falsehoods about vaccines have targeted Paxlovid as well. Some call themselves anti-paxxers. Proactive and health-literate people get the drug. Those who are receiving information more passively have no idea whether it's important or harmful, said Michael Barnett, a primary care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital and an associate professor at Harvard who led the JAMA Network study. In fact, the drug is still free for those who are uninsured or enrolled in Medicare, Medicaid, or other federal health programs, including those for veterans. That's what rescued Hyatt, whose Department of Veterans Affairs health plan doesn't normally cover outpatient drugs. While he searched on his phone for a solution, the pharmacist assistant suddenly appeared from the store. "It won't cost you anything," she said. As Hyatt's case suggests, it helps to know to ask for free Paxlovid, although federal officials say they've educated clinicians and pharmacists like the one who helped Hyatt about the program. "There is still a heaven," Hyatt replied. After he had been on Paxlovid for a few days, his symptoms were gone and his surgery was rescheduled. Pfizer sold the U.S. government 23.7 million five-day courses of Paxlovid, produced under an FDA emergency authorization in 2021 and 2022, at a price of around $530 each. Under the new agreement, Pfizer commits to provide the drug for the beneficiaries of the government insurance programs. Meanwhile, Pfizer bills insurers for some portion of the $1,390 list price. Some patients say pharmacies have quoted them prices of $1,600 or more. How exactly Pfizer arrived at that price isn't clear. Pfizer won't say. A Harvard study last year estimated the cost of producing generic Paxlovid at about $15 per treatment course, including manufacturing expenses, a 10% profit markup, and 27% in taxes. Pfizer reported $12.5 billion in Paxlovid and COVID vaccine sales in 2023, after a $57 billion peak in 2022. The company's 2024 Super Bowl ad, which cost an estimated $14 million to place, focused on Pfizer's cancer drug pipeline, newly reinforced with its $43 billion purchase of biotech company Seagen. Unlike some other recent off-aired Pfizer ads, if it's COVID, Paxlovid, it didn't mention COVID products. The other problem is getting the drug where it is needed. We negotiated really hard with Pfizer to make sure that Paxlovid would be available to Americans the way they were accustomed to, Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra told reporters in February. If you have private insurance, it should not cost you much money, certainly not more than $100. Yet in nursing homes, getting Paxlovid is particularly cumbersome, said Chad Wars, CEO of the American Society of Consultant Pharmacists, specialists who provide medicines to care homes. If someone in long-term care tests positive for COVID, the nurse tells the physician who orders the drug from a pharmacist who might report back that the patient is on several drugs that interact with Paxlovid, Wars said. Figuring out which drugs to stop temporarily requires further consultations while the time for efficacious use of Paxlovid dwindles, he said. His group tried to get the FDA to approve a shortcut similar to the standing orders that enable pharmacists to deliver anti-influenza medications when there are flu outbreaks in nursing homes, Wars said. We were close, he said. It just never came to fruition. The FDA is unable to comment, spokesperson Chinappa Tantabanachakai said. Los Angeles County requires nursing homes to offer any COVID positive patient an antiviral, but the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which oversees nursing homes nationwide, has not issued similar guidance. And this is a mistake, said Carl Steinberg, chief medical officer for two nursing home chains with facilities in San Diego County, which also has no such mandate. A requirement would ensure the patient isn't going to fall through the cracks, he said. While it hasn't ordered doctors to prescribe Paxlovid, CMS on January 4th issued detailed instructions to health insurers urging swift approval of Paxlovid prescriptions given the five-day window for the drug's efficacy. It also encourages plans to make sure pharmacists know about the free Paxlovid arrangement. Current COVID strains appear less virulent than those that circulated earlier in the pandemic, and years of vaccination and COVID infection have left fewer people at risk of grave outcomes. but risk remains, particularly among older seniors, who account for most COVID deaths, which number more than 13,500 so far this year in the U.S. Steinberg, who sees patients in 15 residences, said he orders Paxlovid even for COVID-positive patients without symptoms. None of the 30 to 40 patients whom he prescribed the drug in the past year needed hospitalization, he said. Two stopped taking it because of nausea or the foul taste, a pertinent concern in older people whose appetites already have ebbed. Steinberg said he knew of two patients who died of COVID in his company's facilities this year. Neither was on Paxlovid. He can't be sure the drug would have made the difference, but he's not taking any chances. The benefits, he said, outweighs the risks. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Telegraph Herald. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.